I'm here with Bill Viola at the Anthony Doffe Gallery during his show Five Angels for the Millennium. Mm-hmm. Bill, you've made new work for this show. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about initially the work that's in this show, mm-hmm. but also the ideas that underpin your work and the philosophies mm-hmm. and the fundamental emotions that recur in each of your pieces. Mm-hmm. So if we talk about, first of all, perhaps Man of Sorrows, because mm-hmm. of the expressive emotions in that, mm-hmm. and then talk about some of the other pieces, ending up with the Five Angels and right. the water and the sound sure. audio. So you'll just talk about perhaps Man of Sorrows first.
Okay, well, we're going to take a mental image walk through the gallery right now, which is the way that I kind of conceptualize things, actually. And I think, for me, space has always been a deep part of what I do. And ideas, I believe, exist in a kind of space. That's one reason why this computer model of a desktop in graphics has been so much more effective than the older versions of just a list of numbers and codes, and you enter whatever you need, because we do organize things spatially, both mentally, physically rather, as well as mentally. So coming into the gallery, the first thing you see is, you actually see three pieces. Straight across from you on a wall, there are three panels, small flat panels, which are identical. They're exact same technology as computer laptop panels, LCD digital panels. And there are these three women basically staring directly at you. From across, they're a ways away, and on your left is a large diptych, two vertical panels. Those are plasma screens, which are much larger. Many people have seen them today in kind of shop windows and at airports and stuff, the widescreen kind of flat video things. And then on the right-hand side in the corner, sort of concealed partially when you come in, is this single panel that you referred to called the Man of Sorrows. And that's a 21-inch diagonal flat screen. It's mounted actually on a small stand from behind, and it's leaning back on a small plinth, which people would possibly put a family photograph there or something. It's very much like an object, images object. And so it's just leaning back, and it's a single view of a man, head and shoulders shot. He's against a kind of a gold, brown, yellow background, mottled background. And he's crying, basically. It's an image of a man crying for 16 minutes. He's crying quite deeply at times, and then he'll recover a little bit, and then he'll go back to sobbing. And it's recorded at on high-speed film, which allows the possibility of a slow motion situation while maintaining very high detail of the picture, as well as very, very smooth motion as compared to video. When you slow video down, it gets choppy. Film, especially at higher frame rates, gives you this completely fluid, smooth motion, even at very slow speeds. So there's a fluidity and therefore a lifelike aspect to it, because our motions are not interrupted. There are no frames in human experience. You move your hand, it's continuous gesture. The only way we can seem to render that technologically is to break it up into small parts. So there's this fluidity that returns to the kind of image, to the image. And I did that with a performance artist, Los Angeles-based performance artist by the name of John Fleck. He's become a friend. He's quite an astounding performer, both politically in his work as well as emotionally and physically too. And John's father was ill at the time we were shooting that, and my father had passed away a year and a half before, so his father died a short time after that. So we were kind of commiserating and talking very personally on that afternoon that he came over to shoot that particular sequence. And it kind of connected me back to an event at that time that was about a year and a half old, and for him was quite vivid. So it wasn't very hard to have him go to that really sad place. And like anything, it's even not only the images, which I do hope in the end have some use for people. If you've had experiences like that, you do need to externalize them in some way, have some external connection. And but personally for me, even the act of making it, the act of shooting it that afternoon was really kind of helpful. It had sort of a healing kind of quality, and I think for him too. So it was that's what we're seeing. And a man crying also is, especially in our culture, you know, that's something that us guys are not supposed to do, especially in public.
Continuing that thought, your work is very contemplative. The feeling that you get when you look at it, it does make you look at it and feel emotional. You do connect mm-hmm. with it because it's about emotions we all experience, the joys, the sorrows, the mm-hmm. traumas.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you work often, you have worked with looking at art from the past, yet connecting with those emotions that are in art in the past of the mm-hmm. static, obviously necessarily sure. static images, particularly when you did your work in the National Gallery. And your work in this show, I believe you mentioned that you wanted some of them to operate visually like a kind of altarpiece. Is that correct? So you were thinking of the devotional altarpieces that people could take with mm-hmm. them, and when you look at those pieces, they are about grief, mm-hmm. joy, ecstasy,
mm-hmm.
all those emotions that come into the work. This has been something that you've worked with really from the beginning of your work, and you always seem to find new ways in mm-hmm. to work with.
Mm-hmm.
How do you relate to that in a sense of making the work? Is it, as you say, provoked by meetings with people or working with people that you bring out something in them, or?
You've asked multiple questions there, so let me try to respond to several of them because they're quite interesting. First of all, in terms of the altarpiece and the kind of historical inspiration of the work, the specific, more factual inspiration of the work, I'm not interested really in creating altarpieces per se. I just want to make that clear, you know, like anything that anyone would venerate or worship. But that the form of the work was inspired by these older late medieval, early Renaissance panel painting. In terms of looking at the emotion itself and witnessing it, and the name of the piece you referred to with three women looking at you is called Witness. I was really thinking, I guess, of the emotional content in the work as being more within yourself and not in the image per se. And so this whole issue of representation of actions and emotions and states of being actually comes into play, and it's something I've been dealing with a lot, although I don't sort of participate as directly in, you know, postmodern theory and things like that. I'm not as interested in that. But nonetheless, it's an important issue. So I kind of grew up and went through an art training that really denied the presence of the emotion within the actual image itself. In fact, it was verboten. You just didn't go there. So the interesting thing about the avant-garde tradition is, being an trained in avant-garde tradition, it has a sort of built-in guarantee that whatever they say not to do, you're going to do. It's like the proverbial hand in the cookie jar. Don't open that cookie jar. And what does the kid do? The first thing they do is open it up. So here I am, sort of a little bit older and later in life, dealing with stuff that I remember my professors telling me were implying, really, more so. It just was not something that one did. So it wasn't sort of ironic that not ironic, it wasn't coincidental that I was drawn back to the old master tradition of painting, because after all, that was the place where this idea of the sort of direct representation of suffering, of sorrow, of all these emotions came into being. And it's quite interesting to note that if you look at the history of these pictures, you'll find that let's say, take the crying Madonna, which is probably the most obvious one. And I've done Man of Sorrows here about crying. I did a piece for a show in New York last fall called Dolorosa, which is a man and woman in a kind of a locked, framed, hinged diptych, like a photographic thing you'd have in someone's mantelpiece at home. And you had a man and woman crying. Anybody who's ever been in a relationship knows that that's definitely a major part of it at some point or another. All those crying Madonnas that I dearly love and see, it's quite interesting to hear. I was talking with Marina Warner the other day, who wrote, she's a scholar, fabulous mind, and she wrote a brilliant book on Mary called Alone of All Her Sex, which is a great title. It's all about the myth and cult of the Virgin Mary. We were talking about this, and I asked her, I said, well, you know, when did these tears sort of come into play? And she said, well, in the Byzantine period, which is the period of the icons, and where art was really more kind of graphic and diagrammatic and less sort of representational in the visual sense, because the model that they were going after was not visual. That you have shots of the Madonna with a furrowed brow, but that's about it. And it's not until you get to the Northern Renaissance, 15th century painting up in Flanders, with guys like the Van Eyck brothers and Jerick Bouts and Van der Weyden and all those people who, I mean, I think they're absolutely extraordinary painters. They gave us, for the first time in the history of humanity, the optical image at the highest resolution. I mean, I still believe today one of the most advanced imaging systems on the planet was what the Van Eyck brothers pioneered in the early 1400s, just after the turn of the century. Their masterwork being the Ghent altarpiece, but this whole mode of painting with the new technology of the time, that was like their digital computers of oil painting, which allowed you to paint the reflection on every little individual pearl of the sitter. And so that kind of hyper-reality, high-resolution, high-definition television reality, approaching reality, allowed them to paint the actual tear in all its optical glory with reflections on it and everything. And so then the tears appear when the optical image develops to a certain stage, technically. And then you really have to think, I think often about these painters at that period with their incredibly fine sable brushes painting every little... If you go up close to some of those portraits of the sitters, you even see the stitching in the clothing, you know. It's not a very great step to go from that level of precision to suffering, because it is suffering. If you're going to tackle the material world head on like they did, full glory, without the advantage of this mechanical instrument called the camera where you just push a button and you can get the weave on the clothing if you use a big, large format camera, if you're going to do that by hand, you are in the world of suffering, because the material world is the world of suffering, and our engagement with the material world is suffering itself, you know? I mean, one of the definitions of pain is a prick to the skin. It's an extreme state and extension of the sense of touch, and it's the way you know that you're physically in the world. It's the way you encounter the material world. So, and pain is directly connected to the material dissolution or disintegration or degradation or damage to the human being. And so these guys were in this, it's no wonder that they painted every little wound on Christ's body and all of these really horrific images, really, when you go into these galleries, you know, I take my kids in there sometime and they go, Daddy, what's wrong with that man? You know, it's like, how do I explain this? That this is really a deep, that you have to, you know, go through that to some deeper kind of healing place. But if you're going to go in visually, that's where you're going to end up.
One thing you talk about is the hyperreal, and in your work, because you slow down the frames, what you see is the emotion made more real than you would normally see. Mm-hmm. An expression going through very slowly its motion, so you literally see the face drop into the expression of sadness or joy, happiness. That's very interesting, particularly looking at the triptych witness. You see those minute changes of the expressions, and also the way that we select, the way that when you've got a triptych, you're selecting at some point, your eyes can't look at all of them once, only from a distance. So you tend to focus in on certain ones. Why did you decide to do a triptych in witness? I mean, is that just, do you think it's a more effective way, I mean, of having the three portraits contrasting with each other? Or were you talking about, in some way, perception, how we do select and see?
Well, I mean, human beings, we never really just have one face. We're many faces, many selves, many states of being. And so, it's kind of a paradox, really, because the piece is about a one-to-one. Yet, if I had done it with just simply one image, one panel, it wouldn't be really as effective, because you'd be locked in the gaze. And I should point out that what's going on in this particular piece, these are portraits, head and shoulders portraits, on these 17-inch flat panels, but moving, as you say, in very slow motion. But the key point with witness is they're looking right at you, an unbroken gaze. I mean, those eyes just burn right through that image, right into you. And so it's a very different way of looking. And in the world of perception, human perception, there is one mode of vision that stands out as being unique, and that is the eyeball-to-eyeball, direct gaze. You can look at a stone, I can look at this tape recorder on this table, I can look out the street, I can watch people in the cafe, I can sit across from a friend and have a conversation for a half hour in a pub. But I've never seen two people having a conversation in a pub whose eyes are locked in a gaze. I mean, it's almost impossible to do.
Unless they're madly in love.
And love is very much connected with a vision that goes beneath the surface. So, and these two eyes, which, you know, gateway to the soul, there's little black holes at their center, in fact, little mirrors, and you actually see the image of yourself. The great paradox, which interested philosophers like Plato and has been written about since the ancient world, is if you really go into someone and look deep into their eyes and get really close, what do you see? You don't see them, you don't see their soul, you see yourself. You see the little face of yourself reflected on the little curved surface of the black of the pupil, which in fact creates this second person, and if you try to look closer to them into that little reflection's eyes, what are you going to see? You're going to see another reflection on that eyes reflecting back the person again, and it just goes on and on, a kind of a tautological sort of endless loop, which had fascinated philosophers since ancient times. It's very deep. You can never see seeing, basically. And so so here you have three people staring at you, and the way you engage that image is all or none. There's no way to half look at something like that. You can't let your eyes wander around the Bruegel landscape, and you know, you've got to look them in the eye, because they're looking you in the eye, or you just sort of don't look at them, you know? It really, you see people there and they come up and it's confrontational, really, and then you lock on. And but then there's two other ones looking. So the impossibility of really looking at everyone comes into play. So
moving on to another piece, Surrender. Now that's an interesting piece as well, because again you're working in a hyper-real way but with reflection.
Right.
And at one point the person meets in reality, but what we're seeing is kind of the reflection and part of the person meeting again. Mm-hmm. It's an extraordinarily moving piece. It affects one greatly, and also you have had great interest in water. I mean,
sure.
You refer to it many, many pieces. You refer to it emotionally through your experience when you were a boy, the feelings you had in the water.
Right.
Can we talk a little bit about that, about your use of the reflective quality of water and its transience and the way that things can distort and move in water?
Right. Well, obviously water is, you can't separate water from what people are, from what life is. It is the life fluid. And since, of course, we're not any different than the Earth and this planet, because we are simply just kind of a particular condensation of matter that happened to conglomerate in a certain kind of way that allowed this thing called consciousness to exist. We didn't come from outer space or anything. We just kind of, matter just kind of coagulated in that way over many long, long, long period of time. So it's all part of the same thing. So therefore, it's not coincidental that we have, you know, like 70% of our bodies are water, and
and that water is necessary for life, to the point where there's a group of physicists that in the last, you know, recent years who are starting to consider, you know, water as kind of a unique, kind of standalone kind of element. Personally, for me, I find one of the most moving things about water is it's deeply connected to our self-image, not only our life force and life itself, but the first image that our prehistoric ancestors saw was, and the only way they could possibly see themselves, other than in the pupil of another, is reflection in still water. And that is intimately connected with drinking, with sustenance, leaning over the pool, in the river, in the pond, cupping your hands, looking at your self-image and literally scooping your hands into that image and bring it to your mouth and drinking. Now, that's an extremely profound act that must have, I mean, I just can't imagine what it would have been like for our monkey Australopithecus ancestors. So the water connection is just so deep on so many levels that, you know, it's a lifetime is not even enough to explore it. What happened to me in the making of Surrender, which originally was titled Mirror as of 2 days ago, and might transmute once again, I'm not sure. I came up with this title over breakfast today of Remembrance, going back to the source. So, I don't know. I always have a hard time with titles. We'll see what happens, but we can call it Surrender for now. And so what happens when these two people are standing at the edge of this tank, and you don't actually see the water, really. You're actually seeing their reflection, but the water still, it looks like you're seeing them. And then when they lower their heads down and put their face in the water and come up, the waves, the water gets disturbed, and then you realize their whole figure gets disturbed, and you're actually watching this dissolution of the self optically because of its instability as a series of surface reflections on a disturbed surface. And so what happens is that you have... And at that time, they're actually going through extreme emotional states. I mean, they're getting deeper and deeper into real sorrow and anguish. I told them that this 6x6 foot tank they're standing in front of the two performers, I told them that that was filled with all the tears of the whole world. And that you're going to get sad and go to some deep place of sorrow at the beginning of this performance on an individual level, because all sorrow comes from our own personal reason and connection, specific. And I told them, then when you go down and you put your head in the water the first time, you're actually bringing that sorrow into this pool of tears, and then you're coming up, and instead of receiving relief, which often water can do for us, it's actually making it worse, and you're actually going even deeper now, because it's not just your sorrow, it's everyone's sorrow. So you can really see that in their performance, but at the same time, their image optically is getting more abstract. And so for the first time, I realized why we say that there are waves of emotion. Why we use water metaphors to describe emotion. It's just like water takes us away and throws us around and tosses us and drags us under, that the emotions do the same thing. And so for me, like in the whole show, the whole ground floor part of the show, that for me is the most successful piece, and I say successful in the level of not that I, my little clever scheming mind planned it or anything, but that it was the greatest gift and the biggest surprise, and the most profound for me is the thing I learned the most from that piece than any other piece. Because of this, I mean, now I say it's an obvious connection between emotion and waves of water, movement of water, but I never even thought about that before completing that piece. And that's another important thing that we have lost in our culture, the sense of parallel time. Parallel time is the idea that that you are engaged in an interconnected way with all the points in your life, that parallel time is the vertical axis which punctures and pierces down through the horizontal layers of time. You know, you go to the Grand Canyon, you see all those horizontal layers, and you think, well, that's the Pleistocene, and that's the blah, 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 and the geologists can tell us what they were, when they were laid down, how old they are. So that affects our mental concepts of time and structure of time. And yet, if you took a rod and you penetrated down through those layers simultaneously, the vertical axis is not in our kind of consciousness of time. We think of time as horizontal, moving from left to right. That's how it's portrayed in landscape painting. That's how it appears to us in the movies. We think of the passage of time very much in that way. But if you take the vertical axis, that means you are putting a mark in all these different layers of time. And of course, that is the most accurate representation of the meaning and full import of the present moment. I mean, on one level, there has never been a past and there is not a future. There's only the present. Everybody that's ever lived on the planet has been living in this present moment we're living in right now. And we will leave this room shortly and go out on the rest of our day, and this will become a memory of something, and it will cease to exist literally. So the majority of our experience on this earth is invisible, is about invisible things that don't really exist. And so that's very profound. And if you lose the connection to the present moment as containing all moments, and your life as right now is connecting you to the life of people in the past, not only your own relatives and family, but even in ancient times, if you lose that connection, then what you lose is eternity. You lose the connection of human beings to eternity. You lose the idea that creation is happening as we speak. You lose the idea that Christ's suffering is happening now. It's not something, a historical fact. That Buddha is under the Bodhi tree now, not, you know, 2,500 years ago, that science tells us. You lose literally the sense of the sacred in everyday life. And so that's the point where we're at right now. Evolutionary-wise, historically, that's the importance of media, because whether we like it or not, the media is forcibly, mechanically, with its technological innovations, bringing us back to this notion of this expansive view of time. And you know, every time you make a mobile phone call, you're participating in that. So there is changes in the world which we have not caught up with in and of ourselves, and I believe they are fundamentally spiritual. And that this mechanical stuff we have surrounded ourselves with, this is the country that brought the Industrial Revolution into the world, for heaven's sakes, you know, we still have this view of this separation of spirit and matter, a separation of technology and inspiration and human perfection. And so whether we like it or not, that the only future I can see of the evolution of technological material objects is the joining point, the meeting point further down the road of completely metaphysical spiritual things and completely material technological things. I think it's kind of inevitable.
What I'd finally like to talk about is Five Angels for the Millennium, which is actually the title of the show as well,
right,
which is in the upstairs gallery.
Right.
So perhaps we could just talk about those, because that mm-hmm. has sound, whereas mm-hmm. the other pieces
right.
do not have sound. And audio has been very important in your works
sure.
as well.
Well, once you go upstairs to the Room of the Five Angels, you leave the world of galleries and the conventional, familiar space behind, because you come into a completely black space. All surfaces are painted black except the floor. And you're met with these five large glowing images, these projections on the wall that are placed around the space in such a way that you actually have to move through the space and go around the corner to sort of see them all. And they are all unique and different, and the common aspect of them is they all involve, at one point or another in their cycle, the plunging into the water of a human figure, of a man. And they were done in very kind of simple, there's a very simple manipulation that was going on of that recording of that single plunge that I did with the images. They are either shown right side up or upside down, and they're either running forward in time or reverse in time, and that's all. That's the only thing that I did to change what the camera saw, and it actually is a huge change. I mean, a guy falling in on his back in the water, and we're viewing it underwater, and then floating down and sinking, and you're viewing it from the side underwater. You see him hit the surface above you, fall and go down. If you turn that image upside down, then this surface that's at the above the picture, at the top of the frame, is now at the bottom of the frame. Therefore, it looks like the surface of water. And you actually see someone break through the surface of water, apparently from underneath the water, and then just float up right out of the picture. And the bubbles that are kind of were generated by that plunge and trickling off his arms are now, instead of rising to the surface as he sinks, they're now falling down from above as he ascends. And so you have this image that looks sort of like a human figure dressed in white that has fallen up, trailing what look like stars. And in a what looks like a nocturnal kind of scene at the sea. And I was really amazed myself that just some simple thing like running it backwards or forwards or turning
the shift,
it upside down,
yeah,
just like completely transformed the image. And that's why I decided to call them angels, because they looked like they were going somewhere that definitely was not where we live.
I'm here with Johan Grimompre at the Anthony Doffey Gallery to talk about his latest exhibition, In Flight Lounge. Johan, I saw your Dal History, mm-hmm, documentary, and also here at the Doffey Gallery, and I've read your In Flight magazine. I'd love to talk about Dal History, the development of that into In Flight, and also lots of issues that it's throwing up about banality, wit, mm-hmm, the media,
etc., etc. But what would we like to talk about first? You want to talk about the film first and then trace it on to into the In-Flight?
Yes, if we could talk about Dal History first.
Just to give a little introduction about Dal History. So the tape, a film like 68 minutes, is based on a double narrative. First of all, it traces the history of worldwide airplane hijacking from the beginning of passenger flights until the anonymous suitcase bombs in the 90s. But in a sense, it's also like exploring how those things have been, how those hijackings and those terrorist acts have been represented in the news. So in a sense, it's also like how the news has changed during only a very, very, very short span of media history. That's one. Second, underneath, there is a fictional narrative based on a book by Don DeLillo, taken from Mao 2, where there's a discussion spun between a novelist and a terrorist. And the writer is kind of like meditating on his role as a writer within society, and more or less Don DeLillo contends that the terrorist has taken over the writer's role within society, that bomb makers and gunmen are actually having more of a voice than the writer nowadays. And so it's actually a little bit of a statement also about media, right? So me as a filmmaker positioning myself against the TV landscape or media landscape, the society is saturated with images, and how you place yourself within that as an artist or as a filmmaker.
Now, you trained both as a photographer and as a filmmaker. Photographer in Belgium, and then you went to New York,
yes,
and continued, yes, training in video and film. And that is your preferred medium, although in this show you've also produced...
It depends.
Is it your preferred medium?
I don't know. I've studied lots of other things additional to that as well. And I would say they're just merely tools, right? Just as a film would be a way to express certain ideas and explore certain narratives, and the In-Flight magazine would be another way of telling things. So I had too much material. I had researched a lot during the course of the making of Dial History that I thought, maybe it's interesting to do something with those texts. And they've been around there where I live, and I said, there's so much interesting stuff that didn't go into Dial History. I thought maybe in another way I could do something with that. So that turned into a magazine. But then I didn't want it to just have like a publication that like takes on the same themes. It takes on the same themes, but it takes it a little bit further into what's going on now on the net. And like there's a chapter called Hacktivism. And thanks a lot to Ricardo Domingos, who put me in touch with lots of people that are actually involved with hacktivism and doing actions on the net, and what's going on with the digital zapatismo in the Chiapas in Mexico, but also what's going on in New York. Then RT Mark did a part of the magazine. There's things about eToy. So that's a recent portion of the magazine.
Just to go back to Dal History and then move forward again to the In-Flight magazine. Dal History, when it was showed in Documenta, really grab people. I mean, people, I was in that room and in documentary, and people were kind of very shocked at some of the scenes, and particular ones that have been written about in the press, the cleaners mopping up the blood, the kind of banality of death, and as well as wit and humour, using the music that, mm-hmm, you selected and the text that you've just talked about. When you first conceived of this, I mean, what was your drive to do hijackings? What started you onto this kind of narrative theme?
Well, one thing was definitely what's going on CNN or on the news itself, which is so much more obscene. At least underneath Dal History, this is, I think Dal History is even like very moral. I thought people would have problems with that. but on the contrary, like people like got stuck on the imagery, but never like listened really what was being said. And I thought maybe it confirms what's going on in the film as well, that the terrorists has taken over and that violent images have so much more impact than actually what's being said. And hardly people, I hardly hear people like say, okay, like the narrative and what did you want to say, what's going on between the writer and the terrorist. And then I would say, it actually confirms.
Well, I think what was picked up on was some of the phrases like the woman who at Lockerbie was blasted into her television set and she was watching a programme. And I think what happened was that people focused in on some of the sound bites more than, as you say, the actual general narrative of the film. But also what fascinated me particularly was the way you had selected so specifically these clips, and having sections, for example, when the flights take off or land and they go beyond and they crash, and that kind of repetition of action.
Sure. Well, but it's an exploration of all that vocabulary that's happening on TV. And I would say it's even like the way it's edited, there's even if it's not an overt critical note, it's not a one-dimensional saying of, yeah, this is how it should be or not, it's very much questioning that kind of language. And not only is the questioning there in the narrative and in the text, but also how images are set against one another, or even like the music, how the music is juxtaposed with the imagery. And you clearly see how certain images come before a certain thing. Like, for example, like when you see that you have Donald Duck at the McDonald's in Moscow just before the end scene when Yeltsin is singing Kalinka, Kalinka, Kalinka. Even like in the imagery, you have a critical note, which sometimes you don't find anymore on TV. It's like TV is so much more obscene. Like when publicity, like the way things, or even when you start zapping, the way you can actually look at TV in a very poetic way, but also like in a very obscene poetic way, like how commercials are spliced with news footage, then you say, it's a weird way of how we are bombarded with imagery.
There's one image I remember, out of many that I remember particularly, of where you insert, and it says space for commercial, which is also repeated in the in Flight
Insert
magazine.
Commercial here, yes.
Insert commercial here, and that very much takes you back to what it's all about.
It's a bit all about that gap. It's kind of like what Brecht would do in his theatre, like interrupt and say, hey, listen, guys. But in a way that draws you in, because the music is going on, and in a very seductive way, but actually taking on that seductive language and spinning it around. And yeah, there was lots of criticism because I take it on, but I think nowadays, if you don't take on that seductive language, then you get lost in all the rubbish.
So and what kind of criticism are you talking about specifically that perhaps was being leveled then?
You know, there was this thing of like positioning yourself outside the media in the 60s, like coming up with global TV and trying to invent the counter TV. But I would think nowadays that's so out of the question. It's not possible anymore. And I would say nowadays it's so much more schizophrenic that you place yourself within media, and while you're being absorbed by it and even like take on the same language, you can still be critical. It's very schizophrenic. And then, you know, well, it's also like you're playing at the edge, but it's so important to take on that language and go beyond, because if not, you're not heard, and then you're somewhere in the back, you're somewhere digging like Adorno, making up your critical note, but it's not being heard. And I think it's important like to take on that language,
which
the MTV language. And MTV, like since the 80s, like it's 1980, it's the beginning of CNN, 1981 MTV does its entry, and the way, even it reflects what's going on in society, but the way we look at images and also the way it's been speeded up. Because when MTV introduced itself, they had every 4 seconds another cut, and it used to be 8 seconds or even more. And I think nowadays it's even shorter. Like the soundbites got shorter and shorter. And you see how CNN adapts MTV to talk about reality, to talk about the news, or even adopt Hollywood's aesthetic codes and fictional codes to talk about, you know, you have all the news beats and the sound buttons and the spinning logos. When you see the Gold War, it's like MTV. And this is what the film is also about, how that vocabulary has changed, and how we actually slowly also adapt. And but that's also the way we walk around in reality and go shopping and have a supermarket shot and like put our stuff into the supermarket trolley. And it's the way also we perceive more or less reality nowadays.
Getting back to, as well, what is happening here, you're in Flight Lounge, your installation. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because, again, you have expanded yet also placed this very specifically in a gallery space, the furniture, the coffee machine. Can we talk about the whole way that you put that together?
It's like the logos downstairs, the Visa and the MasterCard logos that say Jack and Master Jack. It's like spinning around what is very banal imagery and that everyday imagery, but then you can twist it around and become something else. And I think it's interesting to like play around with those kind of known codes and then change them. And then certainly you can like push it in certain gaps and show people, like, listen, maybe something else is going on.
I noticed that you do that so much. Looking through the magazines, you've got an advert, in inverted commas, of course, and it's a pear instead of the apple, and you've got who owns the dot.
Right.
And that whole idea, because you look at it, and the way you set these up, you're setting up a dialogue there with the advertising, and yet always what you do is the twist underneath, where you're questioning. Because suddenly people will think, well, who does own the dot? Because it's so much part of our language. So what you were saying before about language inserting things is very pertinent. But can we talk a little bit about the process of selection? I mean, the magazine itself, In Flight, is an enormous undertaking. I mean, just looking at the way it's been put together. Can we talk about how you go about making the work? You mentioned at the beginning that you had a lot of work that you'd already researched for Dial History. Some of that is expanding on Dial History, but there's a lot of new material, of course, as well.
Well, we can leave a bit through it, right? So it starts off and then it starts with Bart Simpson asking, maybe the sky is really green and we're just colorblind, which is kind of like a motto for what's going on, like being soaked in. It's getting the same schizophrenia. You like live in the middle of this language, but then suddenly it's interesting to like show the short sequence in that language and open up a space, a different space that could be critical. So the first chapter, No Man's Land, which is maybe, if people have seen the film, which is the most familiar part, it takes on like the history of the whole theme of Dial History and the history of airplane hijacking. But all the little stories have like a funny twist, like the TWA hijacking of 1985, where there's like all this fuss about a credit card, that they wouldn't get fueled if they didn't have a credit card, for example. Like there's, or Lila Khaled, her Skyjack diary, then when she's in the plane sitting next to this man and actually nearly proposing her to marriage while she's about to get up with a gun and hijack the plane.
Now, can I ask you about the source material for this? Because looking at the credits at the beginning, some of these are actually taken from books, from source material. But with the twists, are these your twists at the end, or are they, for example, the conversation you just mentioned?
Well, I did already the selection as well. I've an amazing stack of documentation of like the last 5 years. Like maybe I've tried to find everything that deals with hijacking, but that was for the purpose of making the film Dial History. And then it's only what you see in the film is the tip of the iceberg. So here I've researched all that material, and then first of all, it's also really what you focus on, the selection that you take. You know, it's the funny bits. But also, like, not only, I don't only want it to be funny. There's always a double bottom, right? So it's hard to explain it as well. But there's always, like, try to make connections that, you know, have a three or a four double bottom kind of, like, reading to it. And that people also, like, can have their own reading to it. But it also depends from chapter to chapter. So you have Lila Khaled's Skyjack diary. And it goes on about all this, definitely also a little bit about the history of hijacking. It takes on what's going on with Cuba. And then that actually in Cuba, hijacking became so popular that they had to expand the runway. And also that shopping became so popular because of all the Americano tourists that were hijacked to Cuba on their side trip and on the Caribbean island, that, you know, the airport tax-free shop had to be expanded too. They made a lot of business. Even like whenever it was an airplane stranded at Cuba, Castro would ask about $3,000 for every plane extra tax and stuff like that. So it became a business.
Well, that's very interesting as well, the way you cite that.
Yes.
The kind of whole business aspect, and
later
developed that in all kinds of different ways.
It's through all the little details. Like, for example, this hijacker that wants to dress up, he's in the toilet, and he wants to dress up, he's struggling with his wig. And I kind of like all these little details. While he's struggling with his wig, he realizes that he left his hijack note on the seat. And then there's a stewardess like saying, anybody forgot this envelope? And then she goes to the toilet, gives the hijack note to the hijacker who's being like struggling with
his
wig.
He doesn't know whether to reclaim it or not, yes.
And it's all the seriousness why you have all this big politics involved. You have at the same time all these little banal details that make those, you know, it's like making those world politics into your own like little story of every day. And even the hijackers or the captains, they all have like their little stories of their wife and et cetera, et cetera.
I think there was many moments about that. For example, what the birthday of the stewardess is, those little details.
Mm-hmm.
But also, in the beginning, quite poignantly, at the beginning of the In Flight magazine, where you're talking about Khalid again, and she's saying she'd been dealt, she knew how to deal with all the situations, but she didn't know and hadn't been prepared for how to deal with those conversations that you have.
Exactly.
And so suddenly the human element is inserted, and of course that makes you think more than anything else.
Also with very intimate politics, the fact that, you know, again, woman and a man and the plane and all this like little intimate politics are being in there. And
what was she doing? Where was she going? What was her purpose? Which was innocent questioning, which every moment could have tripped her or trapped her.
So there's a story about this fake airport being built. Like, there was this... They were tossing the idea of building a fake airport, Havana Airport in Miami. But also at one point, there was this hijack from the first Japanese Red Army hijack, the first hijack in Japan, where they took a plane from Fukuoka to... They wanted to go to Pyongyang, to North Korea, but then they got stalled in... Here we go. Bad history. They got stalled in Seoul. And Seoul, what they did, they took out everything that looked Western and dressed up the airport as it was Pyongyang to trick the hijackers. But then there's the jazz radio, American jazz radio, that gave the ploy away. It was partly mentioned also in Dial History. But the little episode is written here in the In Flight magazine, with all these little stories. But that's the first chapter, right? Also like how four planes were taken on one day down to Dawson in a desert earth strip. Or the title of the show, Your Words Have Reached My Ears, which is a control tower cockpit conversation, which has become the title of the show, Your Words Have Reached My Ears. So there's all these little anecdotes in the film, in the magazine. And then the next chapter, so we could go chapter by chapter, because it also goes a bit chronologically, right? The first chapter is a bit nostalgic, it's still dealing with the hijacking, but then it goes on to the anonymous suitcase bomb, to cyberjacking, like what's going on the web. But in between, before we go to the 80s, we have this chapter basically focusing on David Hubbard, who was a psychiatrist specialized in hijackers. And he describes, because it's interesting, you know, if you talk about an in-flight magazine, right, it's to be read in the sky. It's to be read above the clouds. And you could like take that on as a kind of a metaphor, because it's also about dreaming and the utopia being projected. And definitely about hijacking, you know, you hijack a plane, you're on the way from one country to another, but they hijack a plane into no man's land to take it to another country, hostile country, or actually like what Lila Khaled did, claim her own country. She said, we don't have a country to fight a war, so she said, we claim a no man's land and baptize it into like our territory. She renamed the plane as Palestine, because it didn't have the territory to fight a war, so they take this kind of in-between country. And in that sense, it's also kind of this utopian projection. But in the sky, you could say, like, you it's like that little moment when you take a plane. Definitely when I come back from New York and I have... It's really like you close a moment, because you go from one space to another, you go back to Europe. You have a moment to think, and then you realize your hopes and your dreams, or maybe you're going to see your beloved, and et cetera, all these things. And it's an important moment. And that's when the in-flight supposedly should be read. It's like that moment where you actually are exploring a bit your dreams.